Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. I have to admit that I have dabbled a little bit into artificial intelligence. We all have, even if we may not quite realize it. But I did it deliberately by using one of those artificial intelligence art creator websites. It's where you type in a bunch of commands and out comes a picture of what the program at least thinks that you are trying to make. It was remarkable. Now, I wasn't skilled enough to give the proper commands to make it look exactly how I wanted it to, but I was still wildly impressed by what came out of it. I was in awe, to be honest. And for about a week, I got hooked on this website. I even spent a little bit of money on it, which I came to regret a little bit later, but I spent many hours on this site, and it was amazing to me that I could take something that was in my mind, if I could just think of the right words to describe it, and this artificial intelligence program would just create it. Anything, really. It felt godlike. Not that I know what that feels like, but that's what I thought. But it also felt like I was playing with fire, where anyone could create any image, or now even video, and make it look real. I could create something, and anyone could create something that was just false, and make it look real. Now, I think I can still pick out an artificial intelligence created image because usually maybe they're a little too polished, a little too perfect when I see them. But I still see people on social media all the time sharing such images thinking that they are real. And so I think about what does this mean about truth in society, or what does this mean even for artists today? If I need some artwork done for my radio program, I don't have to go find an artist to do it anymore and pay them. I could just do it through these artificial intelligence-backed programs. And of course, we could expand that to almost any kind of job. I mean, even jobs that use your voice, like mine, are not entirely safe. So today we're going to be in conversation about artificial intelligence. We're going to talk about the companies that are driving it and the personalities as well, and where they think they are going. Joining me for this conversation is Karen Howe. Karen Howe is an award-winning journalist. She covers the impacts of artificial intelligence on society. She writes for such publications as The Atlantic. She leads the Pulitzer Center's AI Spotlight series, and she is the author of the book. It's called Empire of AI. Karen Howe, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this program.
Thank you so much for having me, Mitch.
And welcome to the old media. This is a radio program. And on radio, not exclusively, but largely, our demographics of listeners tend to be a little bit older, perhaps mature is a better way of putting it. And there might be some, and of course, not everyone, but there's probably a lot of folks who are not quite up to date where we are technologically, and you will be patient with me, for as every day I am becoming more and more part of this group as well. So I'd just like to begin with a few basic questions about artificial intelligence. The first, what is it? I'm sure you've had to explain to people who ask you the same question. How do you describe to people what is AI?
Yeah, this is always actually a harder question than many people realize, in that AI actually refers to many different things. It's many different technologies. I think people generally associate them in modern day with chatbots, with the image generators that you talked about, but there's a whole other range of technologies that also are slapped on the name AI. So things like your social media algorithm, your Google search engine, your Netflix recommendation algorithm, Amazon product recommendation algorithm, the autocomplete on your phone, all of these are different AI systems, and they are of varying sizes, scales, trained on different types of data, and of course they serve different purposes. So one of the analogies that I often use is the word AI is a little bit like the word transportation, in that there's many different forms of transportation. You can have bikes, self-driving cars, rocket ships, they're all meant to do one thing, move you from point A to point B, but of course they have different mechanisms by which to do that. And if there was that same one thing about AI, the common thread is that they're all trying to, in some way, mimic a type of human capability, whether it's our reasoning ability, our conversational ability, our ability to see things or hear things or to speak. And they all kind of end up falling in these various categories.
I'm not going to pretend as though I understand it much, but it is fascinating to me because language is really important for AI, isn't it?
Modern day AI systems are, yes, absolutely. A lot of it is constructed on language. And part of the reason why is a bit of an anomaly around how AI started developing in towards chatbots. There's a very long history of the AI discipline being quite fascinated with chatbots because when the field originally pegged its idea around what it was trying to achieve to artificial intelligence, this phrase of recreating human intelligence, they started looking at different ways of trying to replicate things that might appear to be human. And so chatbots became a very early form design for the software that people started calling AI. And so, all fast forward all the way to modern day, we now have these massive companies, extremely wealthy companies that are pumping extraordinary amounts of resources into creating language-based AI technologies. And what they do is they pour as much language as they can scrape off of the internet, all of the sentences, paragraphs, stories, textbooks, articles that have been written and that are available online. They scrape it, pour it into this software algorithm, train it up, and then out pops a language model that becomes the basis of something like ChatGPT.
And what is a language model? What does that do?
Yeah, so the most basic way to understand a language model is that it is quite literally modeling how we communicate with one another through language. And so it is analyzing all of these sentences and paragraphs that have been shown it during the training process, and it is statistically trying to figure out how often do people use certain words next to one another? How often do you have a noun and then a verb and then an adjective and an adverb? And it slowly starts to derive the rules of syntax, grammar, slang, other figures of speech, and then use that to construct a so-called model, a template of how language is typically strung together and then communicated. And in modern day language models, the way that they end up constructing their sentences is they try to, as accurately as possible, predict the next word in a sequence of words. So if you say to the language model, once upon a, it's probably going to spit out time. And that is essentially the core essence of how language models are trained today.
So prediction is a big part of how artificial intelligence works.
Yes, exactly. And specifically data-driven prediction. So they are analyzing vast repositories of that data to then predict what is the most likely thing that happens next, what is the most likely word that happens next, or what is the most likely pixel that happens next to get the image generators to work.
So when I'm doing one of these websites again that creates art, and I'll just put in I don't even get that detailed. I'll just put in like two or three quick phrases, and it's predicting what it thinks I'm looking for or trying to create.
Yeah, it's both trying to predict your intent and it's trying to predict what pixels would come together to achieve that intent. So there's kind of two prediction tasks at play. It's both trying to analyze you and what you want, as well as how to construct that in an image.
And is that what we do naturally with intelligence?
It's a huge debate because all the way up until present day, we still do not know what intelligence really is and why humans seem to have something that makes us a so-called superior species to all other species in this particular dimension. And throughout the history of computing, one of the interesting phenomenon that has happened over time is that every time there's an advancement in computers, people start to believe that that's also exactly how our brains work. So back when memory and hard drives and all this stuff was created, people started believing that we also had memories and hard drives, and we were retrieving things from a database that was being stored in our brain. And now we talk about our brains as though they are language models. And we actually don't really, there isn't any scientific consensus around whether or not it is actually how our brains work, but it has certainly become a popular colloquial way that people sometimes reference their own intelligence.
But my questions are pretty simple, but hard to answer, right? I mean, these are.
They are. No, I think the simplest questions within AI research and development are always the most hard to answer, because you realize that the premise of this technology, of this scientific discipline, is actually quite shaky and it's squishy. Like the fact that we've built an entire enterprise on this term, artificial intelligence, and we don't have actually even know what the second word means, intelligence, is, it's a pretty good encapsulation of one of my central critiques of this technology, is that we're ultimately building something where we don't actually have clearly defined what the goalposts are, and yet we're pouring an extraordinary amount of resources and both material and financial and labor resources into this enterprise, and we don't know where we're going.
It feels like in just a matter of a couple of years, maybe even a matter of 6 months, or even just the last year, artificial intelligence has been added to so many things and has changed so many things. Is that that's what it feels like. Is that at all accurate?
It's 100% accurate. So, I mean, before ChatGPT and the whole influx of chatbots and image generator tools, of course, there was plenty of AI that people were interacting with, but it was much more back-end AI. It wasn't very consumer-facing. So when you would use your email, there was a spam filter running in the background that was AI, but you never interacted with it. Maybe every occasionally you would mark something in your email as this is spam, or you would catch something in your spam folder and say, this is not spam, this was actually an important email. And that was you actually training this back-end AI system. But other than that, by and large, it was invisible. Whereas now it's very, very visible. There's all these consumer systems that are being pushed into the marketplace, and people are being encouraged to use these tools that are directly accessible through a web browser or on their app, and they're speaking and chatting with these AI systems for the first time. And these types of systems are much more expensive to develop. They require a lot more data. And so they are being much more actively pushed by companies, because companies want more and more users to use them to then accumulate more of the data that they need for training the systems, as well as to figure out how to monetize a larger user base so that they can pay back the investments that they've poured into building this technology.
In your book, Karen Howe, Empire of AI, you take on the narratives that are out there about AI. Really, the two main narratives is one, it's going to create a utopian world in the future, and it's going to give us all this leisurely time as the machines and the computers and the programs do all the work. And on the other end, the other narrative is that it's the doom for humanity. It's going to take over and humans won't be needed anymore. You write that this is really two sides of the same coin, these two super narratives about AI.
So one of the things that I think is not often understood by the general public about why AI has suddenly seemed to appear out of nowhere and seems to be accelerating really fast, and to your point, has now popped up everywhere and is being pushed on us, is in part because of this quasi-religious movement, multiple quasi-religious movements that have cultivated within the Bay Area, within Silicon Valley, around what this technology is and what it could achieve. And they very much split into the camps that you just described. I call them in my book the boomers and the doomers, which is how they're sometimes colloquially referred to. The boomers believing that AI will bring us to utopia, the doomers believing that it'll bring us to dystopia. And inherent in both of these movements, the reason why I label them as quasi-religious is because they really do believe that AI is a new form of intelligence that is being created, which again, we don't really know what intelligence is, so this is part of the belief that they just simply think that it's almost like a new species that is coming into being, and that it is going to be superior potentially to humans, and therefore either solve all of the problems that we've never been able to solve because it's just smarter than us, or lead to our destruction because throughout history, any superior species has subjugated the inferior species. And so I think they're two sides of the same coin in the sense that they both paint AI as this incredibly powerful, potentially a technology that potentially will gain consciousness, sentience, will start to have agency, and then will be able to develop wants, desires, and needs that either benefit or destroy us. And this perpetuates a general overhyping of the capabilities of the technology. It assigns an enormous amount of agency to a technology that is ultimately being developed by people, and it is people who are deciding how to design this technology and how to deploy the technology. And so I ultimately think that these quasi-religious movements essentially distort our understanding of what this technology actually is and how we should be handling how to successfully integrate it into our lives.
So you think AI is overhyped?
It is absolutely hugely overhyped. Yeah, it is overhyped in sort of a couple of ways. The first one is just the way that Silicon Valley tech executives they describe AI capabilities, that is very overhyped. You know, like Sam Altman just said after releasing GPT-5 that it represents PhD level intelligence in your pocket. This is just, you need to understand this as just marketing rhetoric. You know, like GPT-5 still flubs on the most basic tasks. People have been all over the internet on social media showing ways that GPT-5 still fails to count the letters in a word, still fails to do basic arithmetic. While on the other hand, it does also achieve remarkable things in other dimensions, it's clearly highly uneven. It's unpredictable. There's still not a good understanding of the mechanisms by which it sometimes fails and sometimes succeeds. And generally, to try and analogize it to PhD level intelligence begins to anthropomorphize it a lot. It begins to suggest that it is highly reliable, trustworthy, extremely smart in every dimension. And the other way that it's overhyped is that because of this perception that AI is more capable than it actually is, there is an extraordinary amount of money being poured into this technology, both into companies like OpenAI and Anthropic and Google that are actually developing these l language models and other types of AI models, but also from the older generations of companies that are trying to now adopt AI within their organizations and writing blank checks to try and bring themselves up to speed in the AI era. And what we've seen by and large is that it has not, while it, you know, there are a lot of pilots and experiments and all this stuff going on, it is not leading us to a fundamentally new type of economy. It's not leading us to historic growth in the ways that the marketers of this technology tell us it will.
Part of the narrative is to drive in investment. Storytelling's a big part of this industry.
Yeah, one thing that I really love is Signal President Meredith Whitaker often says that hype is actually just a feature, not a bug, of venture capitalists and their model of how investing works. They pour money in to a very highly risky early stage bet, and then they essentially cash out by hyping it up as much as possible until they get to a point where they can exit, like the startup goes public, the startup is acquired, whatever it is, and the valuation at that exit is really driven by how much inflationary rhetoric they can sort of pump into the bubble before that happens, so that when they cash out, they get greater returns on investment. And so Silicon Valley has cultivated these tactics where they tell these really evocative stories about the future and how it's going to be wonderful or potentially devastating. And that's why you need to give them all the money to help control and make sure that it doesn't become devastating. But it's just all to kind of continue feeding this idea that the technology is omnipotent, it's inevitable, and there's really nothing that you can do other than hop on board.
In a moment, I want to dive into really what the meat of your book is about, and that is the Silicon Valley company OpenAI and Sam Altman, its leader. But one last question, just sort of what people are thinking about AI today. With such statements as in a couple of years, 25% of the workforce is going to be displaced, do you think that's a reasonable thing to think?
What I always say is that it's not AI that's replacing jobs, it's executives deciding to lay off workers and replace them with AI. So I think it is reasonable in that context that we could soon have extraordinary amount of job displacement because executives of companies decide that AI is good enough. And sometimes, there was already a case where a company literally laid off workers, said that they were going to replace their workers with AI, and then had to walk it back because they realized that AI just did not cut the bar when they thought it did. So a lot of this is still hype, but certainly there's many, many executives that are now moving in that direction. So I do not think that it is off the table that that could happen.
I mean, AI may not cut the bar yet, but it just seems like it's going to, right? It's coming. This is Letters in Politics, and we are in conversation with Karen Howe. Karen Howe is the author of the book Empire of AI. The company that you really focus on in your book, The Empire of AI, is called OpenAI. And this was fascinating to me to learn about this company from Silicon Valley because it started off as a nonprofit.
Yes. So OpenAI, builder of ChatGPT, arguably the most capitalistic company in existence today, is technically still on paper a nonprofit because that is how it started.
And
So
it
it was
started as a
co-founded.
right. I mean, it's not just happened to be a nonprofit. It purposefully was a nonprofit, meant to do nonprofit kind of things to work against the profit interest.
Yes. So it was co-founded by Elon Musk and Sam Altman and a group of other researchers. And at the time, Elon Musk and Sam Altman, their idea was we want to create a counter to the for-profit incentives of Silicon Valley to ensure that AI development doesn't go wrong. Because if it's developed in an environment that is purely driven by commercialization and gets into these race dynamics where different companies are just developing it as quickly as possible to compete for market share, certainly that could lead to really detrimental consequences. And so they created the nonprofit as an idea of we're going to only develop AI in a completely idealistic environment without any pressures of needing to develop a product and purely with the intentions of benefiting all of humanity. And that lasted about 1.5 years. And what happened at the 1.5 year mark is OpenAI then was thinking, in order for us to develop AI to benefit all of humanity, we need to be number one in AI development. And in order for us to be number one in AI development, we should probably develop super advanced AI capabilities as quickly as possible. And in order to do that, we are going to choose to aggressively scale up the existing AI technologies today with more data, larger supercomputers, and more money than has ever been tried before, so that we can get to our goal methodically and as quickly as possible. Suddenly, the bottleneck became capital because they needed to buy these really massive supercomputers. They needed to build them. And then the nonprofit model just didn't hold. And so they created a for-profit arm to nest within the nonprofit for raising that extraordinary levels of capital. And that is still the structure that OpenAI technically has today, where it's a nonprofit with a for-profit nested within it. And that for-profit is now valued at $300 billion and potentially soon $400 billion.
I can't help but think that this is that there's an economic bubble that's growing here, that's going to pop at some point. You mentioned all
Yeah,
the money
I
that's being
mean, I've
invested.
spoken with investors who themselves have really warned that they think that this is a bubble that could lead, when it pops, could lead to something worse than the 2008 financial crisis, because the degree of risk and capital concentration that is happening in AI that will have ripple effects across the economy is something that we've never seen before. The largest company, the highest valued companies in the world today, most of them, their valuations are going up and up and up and up because of just this one thing, because of the AI hype. And they're pumping all of this money into infrastructure, these supercomputers and data centers for powering their AI systems and deploying their AI systems. And the money that is being invested into all of this is coming from things like people's retirement funds and university endowments and other parts of the economy that you wouldn't necessarily think are linked to the tech industry and this AI bubble, but are. And so if the bubble pops, it's not just the investors that lose out on the money. It's all of the money, all of the different corners of the economy that they pooled the money from that are also going to feel those effects.
I suspect listeners were surprised to hear the name Elon Musk as a co-founder of OpenAI. Again, as it began, was meant to be a nonprofit to try to create artificial intelligence without a profit motive, and that version of Elon Musk may not square with the version that we think of Elon Musk now, after serving time with Doge in Washington, D.C., being on a stage with a chainsaw, these kind of things. How do you see Elon Musk in this story?
Elon Musk, at the time when he co-founded OpenAI, I mean, it was a totally different time, both in the world and for him. You know, he was still considered a Silicon Valley golden boy. He was still lauded as the miracle founder of Tesla and SpaceX and PayPal, and had generally a good track record, and people really hung on every word of his. And I think he himself leaned into that I have a responsibility persona, and really, you know, part of him creating OpenAI was he really felt like it was incumbent upon him to shepherd this technology and responsibly. And he was actually having meetings with President Obama, talking to President Obama about you need to keep watch on this technology and you should actually move quickly to regulate it. And of course, and a key part of the story is that Sam Altman actually basically cultivated the relationship with Musk and got Musk to become his co-founder by appealing to that sense of responsibility and appealing to what Altman framed as a shared belief in needing to mitigate the risks of AI. And so Musk, fast forward to today, very different Musk, very different world, very different administration. But one of the things that has been become sort of an overhang that continues to plague Altman and OpenAI is that Musk left the company at some point because he was not pleased with the fact that it wasn't staying a nonprofit, and also he wasn't going to be the CEO of the for-profit entity. And so now that OpenAI is extremely successful, Musk has been suing Altman and OpenAI, and he alleges that Altman tricked him into a false premise for the company that he alleges that Altman had always intended for it to be a for-profit, and that he'd sort of lured Musk in with this nonprofit premise just to get Musk to donate a bunch of his own money to prop up the original organization.
Sam Altman is at the center of your book, Empire of AI. What's important to know about Sam Altman?
So Sam Altman's the CEO of OpenAI. He was formerly the president of Y Combinator, one of the most prestigious startup accelerators in Silicon Valley. And he was relatively well known, well, he was extremely well known in the tech world before he became the head of OpenAI, specifically for startups and entrepreneurship because of his role as the YC head. And he has always been seen as an incredibly strategic person. And his detractors will say that he is very manipulative in his in his ability to strategize. And his boosters will say that he is one of the greatest leaders, tech leaders of our generation, akin to Steve Jobs. And he part of his superpower is that he's really good at telling stories, which is the currency of Silicon Valley. He is very, very persuasive. So he's an excellent recruiter of talent. He persuades people to join in on the particular quest that he's fixated on in that moment. And he's very persuasive to investors. So he's an excellent fundraiser. And over time, he has been able to, throughout his career, sort of outmaneuver a lot of people to get what he wants. And in this particular moment in time, he has put all of his energy and focus on AI and then fusion energy, one of his other bets. And that has been his fixation, like his life energy, so to speak, is all being channeled towards that direction. And part of my reporting from the book showed that it almost felt a little bit like he was unstoppable. You know, people have tried to negotiate with him on different ways of approaching AI development and have all been unsuccessful. And it's sort of just Sam Altman's show.
What do you think his ultimate goal is? Now, he wouldn't talk to you, and you say this right at the front of your book, Empire of AI, and it happens. What do you think the goal here is?
It's a great question. Like, what is Altman's ultimate goal is a great question, because, you know, no matter how many people I interviewed and how closely they had worked with Altman for however long, no one could articulate what his goals are. Like, what does he actually want? What are his values? No one could really say. And you know, like, these are people that on the face of it know him really, really well because they've been by his side for many years. But in terms of what OpenAI's stated goal is, you know, they're trying to build a superior so-called artificial general intelligence, a form of AI software that ultimately can do anything that a human can do and then more. And if you look at the revealed preference of Altman and what he's trying to achieve, one of the key dimensions of understanding the AI development ecosystem today is that every billionaire has their own AI endeavor. And I think that's an important fact to really understand what ultimately they think AI can do for them. It is sort of the ultimate quest, the ultimate political, economic, capital accumulation vessel. And it is the ultimate arena in which they can battle one another with trying to gain control over a technology that they want to make in their own image.
And you are listening to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Today we are in conversation with Karen Howe, author of the book Empire AI. We'll return to our conversation with Karen Howe after this quick musical break with Frédéric Chopin. This is Letters on Politics, and we are in conversation with investigative journalist Karen Howe, author of the book Empire of AI. Karen Howe, is it true that Sam Altman, the founder of and the leader of OpenAI and developing artificial intelligence, was influenced by the movie named Her?
He says that, whether or not that is an actual honest reflection of his internal thoughts, you know, is still hard to say, but he regularly evokes that with people at the company saying that Her is ultimately what OpenAI is trying to achieve, this seamless AI assistant, super assistant that just integrates into people's lives and is delightful and is something that just steps in whenever the user needs something, and they don't feel like there's any kind of friction or burdensome user interface. So yeah, that has been a longstanding goal picture that is painted within OpenAI for what AGI should look and feel like.
I mean, that was interesting to me because the movie Her, I liked the movie too, and it's about this lonely guy who this AI assistant, I think it's the voice of is Johanna Scarlett.
Scarlett Johansson.
Yes, see, I'm not with the times, but thank you. Is the voice actor, and it keeps him company, keeps him feeling connected, and it just made me think when I heard that Sam Altman's that he continually brings up this film, Her, about the human condition of loneliness and how appealing that could be to people, that something like an AI assistant could fill a void. I mean, it just makes me think about how alluring this could be and how it could get into the depths of the human psyche.
Yes, I mean, it's already happening now. Like just this week, people were making analogies again to the movie Her because OpenAI made its most recent update from GPT-4o to GPT-5, and originally the company thought that they would just completely deprecate GPT-4o, so users wouldn't be able to access it anymore. They get GPT-5, but the problem is there's entire communities of users that have developed deep relationships with their AI chatbots, the way that Spike Jonze portrays in the movie. And when GPT-4o was deprecated and swapped in with GPT-5, there were all of these users started lamenting that they had lost their loved one. They had lost the person, like it wasn't the same personality anymore, it didn't do the same things, and so on. And so people have been making this analogy to the scene in the movie where Joaquin Phoenix is tapping on his phone and it says, operating system not found or whatever. And he starts getting really stressed and anxious because Scarlett Johansson has now disappeared into the ether. And that is qu almost literally what some people are feeling right now with having their companion upgraded, but the previous companion lost.
That's funny. If I just think about like Siri, and I got to be careful because I don't want any of my phones to go off, or one of the smart speakers when they change the voice, and the voice that you weren't used to anymore is gone. That affects people. It has affected me. Like, hey, where I don't like this voice. Where is that voice I was using before? So we do feel that connection.
Yeah, people build really, really strong connections with technology. And part of it is because, humans psychologically through since the beginning of time have projected ourselves onto even inanimate objects. So anything that appears to speak to us will be even more persuasive in making us feel like they're actually real, they're another being. That there are friends, that there are lover, whatever it is. And it's actually become quite a huge problem with AI companions today, is that sometimes users end up being developing extremely obsessive and unhealthy relationships with these AI tools, and it leads to rapid deterioration of their mental health.
This is the modern day, and you've used this word, anthropomorphizing. I mean, this is, if we can do it to a rock, I mean, I get, imagine if it talked back to us.
Yeah, exactly. And I think about it all the time when I'm like, as kids, when we're watching the clouds and we're seeing faces and shapes just in these fluffy nebulous structures. I mean, our imagination to project human-like things onto anything is just so powerful.
We do it naturally. So, of course, we continue to do it naturally with something that's even more interactive with us and predictive of our own behavior. I do want to talk in our time remaining, Karen Howe, about your comparison of the AI industry right now to 18th and 19th century colonialism.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, so the central argument of my book is that we really need to think of companies like OpenAI as new forms of empire. And the reason I say this is because they are operating at a scope and scale that is truly historic and can only be paralleled by these former empires. They also have all of the features of former empires. They engage in an extraordinary amount of labor exploitation. Both in the fact that the technologies that they're creating in the process require a lot of labor exploitation, which I talk about in my book. I go to Kenya, I go to Colombia to meet some of the workers that work in sweatshop-like conditions to create these systems like ChatGPT. But labor exploitation also in the sense that these AI models actually lead to further labor exploitation because executives are now automating away people's jobs, and workers are losing their bargaining rights and other types of rights along the way. People are losing economic opportunity. Empires also engage in an extraordinary amount of resource extraction, and we are seeing these companies going all around the world to acquire land, energy, water to build their data centers, power them, and cool them. And they're also extracting an extraordinary amount of minerals in order to build those data centers. Empires also monopolize knowledge production. And we have seen with AI research that most of the AI researchers today work at these companies. And you could imagine, like, if most climate scientists in the world worked for oil and gas companies, we would not get an accurate picture of climate science. And that is what is happening with AI research now. All of it is being filtered through the lens of what is good or not good for these companies or for these empires. And the last feature is that empires always have this narrative of good versus evil empires. They have to be a good empire to beat back the evil empire. And we see this in the rhetoric that I mentioned, this quasi-religious rhetoric of AI could either bring us to heaven or to hell. So which one do you want? Do you want us to be in control and to bring you to heaven? Or do you want an evil bogeyman like China to be in control and bring us to hell? And so all of these companies, they've using all of these different imperial tactics, have concentrated an extraordinary amount of economic and political power. And they have now become essentially the apex predator in the ecosystem. There's no other higher power to these companies anymore. You know, you could argue that the US government once was the higher power that would regulate these companies, but under the Trump administration, the US government has made very clear that it's unwilling to play that role. And in fact, it's actually going to supercharge the conquest of these companies to acquire ever more land, ever more data, ever more water, energy, data centers, and so on and so forth. So it is the only metaphor that I've ever found to encapsulate the absolutely extraordinary magnitude upon which these companies are aggressively reshaping our politics and terraforming the earth.
I feel like it's a really important point, and the point about there's a slant that the information AI is giving us. There's a slant to it. There is a bias to it.
Yes, which is not even a part of the empire analogy that I often talk about, but is actually yet another parallel in that the software that they're creating has an ideological bias. You know, we've seen this most obviously with Elon Musk and XAI, and Grok, you know, had that really strange week where it just kept talking about white genocide in South Africa. And that was a perfect example of a more extreme manifestation of what's actually happening with all the chatbots, that they are all being encoded with a very specific ideology for what they say versus don't say, what values they have or don't have. And that is, you know, that is then being disseminated to anyone who uses the tool and anyone who builds on top of the tool. And that's basically what empires did as well, is they would disseminate their ideology of what they wanted everyone in the world to believe, whether it was Christianity or whether it was the superiority of Europeans or what have you. And that then led not just to a colonialism of resources, but a colonialism of mind.
It's interesting because you would think I could see people thinking because this is coming from a machine, this information's coming from a machine that it would be neutral.
Right, but it's not actually coming from the machine. It is the people who create the machine that decide what the machine does and says.
Karen Howe, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Mitch.
Karen Howe has been our guest. Again, the name of her book is Empire of AI. That does it for Letters and Politics. The show is produced by Deanna Martinez. Kirsten Thomas is the engineer. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and I thank you for listening.